Good afternoon. It's 12:46 p.m., January 23rd, 2012. Monday afternoon, it has been one busy day. I left the house this morning at around 8:20. I haven't been back long enough just to drop off the car and get out on the road to walk. I had to take kid to school, had a breakfast meeting, had therapy, got a haircut, took myself out to lunch, and went home. And when I get back, I think I'll have just about enough time to get this uploaded before I have to go pick up kids from school and start the afternoon. This is an early release day. So that means kids get out an hour and a half early, so teachers have some professional development time in the school. Following that, I have to take younger daughter back to school at 4 o'clock so that she can be there for her play rehearsal. Assuming, of course, she gets a part, which she doesn't really know yet. So, yeah, I got trimmed. Right at the moment, there's more hair on my face than there is on my head. On my scalp. All the hair, of course, is on my head, except for that which is below my neck, but that's another story. The place I go is for a barber shop for men, and they specialize in beard trimming and manly men. They do a really good job, so it's a nice place to go to get a really top-notch haircut for me. And I try to do that 3 or 4 times a year. It's a little spendy, but it's not too bad. And getting the beard in shape before the con this weekend was one of the key elements. And yeah, the con is this weekend. Holy cow. Friday, I'll be driving down to Colorado Springs for a couple of days of Cosine. The podcast, I don't know what will happen. I would like to continue it, but we will see how that all works out. It may work out, it might not. I don't know. The con schedule is a lot more demanding. I think I've got something like 6 panels. There's one on Friday, 4 on Saturday, and two on Sunday, 1 on Sunday. I forget now. They sent me a calendar that has all the schedule on it. Of course, I looked at it and said, yeah, that's great, because I don't care. Put me in. It's going to be a game, apparently, tomorrow night. Not tomorrow night, Friday night. A Jeopardy. For me, what makes the Hidalgo work is that it's layered. And that we have this almost mythical creature in Dr. Mercury. Evil, not necessarily for evil's sake, but evil by comparison to society, evil by comparison to the norm. And worse, and the hero of the story, calls her out on it. The woman who cannot be controlled by shame. I look around and I see all of the women who are controlled and controlling to a certain extent by shame. And think, yeah, you know, culturally, I suppose all cultures govern through guilt. Peer pressure. I feel guilty for not being part of the tribe. But Dr. Mercury is independent. She's very dark. She kills people. She has no remorse. She likes the taste of blood. Other people's blood, but she's not particular. Because she likes the taste of pennies. It's an interesting notion, it's an interesting idea. I haven't thought about the construction of the Hidalgo. Although some conversation that I was having today brought it up. And the juxtaposition of religion with horror and humor. The idea that Fernando would pray to the Blessed Virgin Mary for deliverance, not in the end from Dr. Mercury, but to Dr. Mercury. I wonder where the hell my head was when I wrote that story. And I wonder how I get it back there, because there's something in that story that is hugely powerful, and I don't really know what it is. It's creepy, yeah. It's funny in places. It's Don Juan de la Mancha, Don Quixote, but twisted. A Sancho Panza that's somehow wrong. And to a certain extent, the astonishing amulet of Amenartas has a similar kind of darkness to it. The lead character who's called by the amulet, who's offered its infernal power, and yet manages to avoid it. Not necessarily through strength of will, but out of fear for what he saw his friend, his colleague, if not strictly speaking his friend, go through. The idea that to embrace the amulet means to lose himself. And he wasn't a man who was all that thrilled with himself to begin with. Those are some interesting works, and very different from anything that I've ever done before or since, if, of course, you don't count what happened to Ishmael at the end of Onsher. If you don't count, I suppose, the battle that Tanith has with Andrew Birchwood. Some interesting ideas chasing themselves around in my head today. I'm not exactly sure what's given rise to them. Oh, I'm feeling a little lame right at the moment, quite frankly. I don't know quite why, because it's not like I've been sitting in my chair all day. I've been pretty much on the go for most of it. The haircut and beard trim. The beard feels kind of funny because there's actually quite a lot less of it right at the moment. But it's even and it's almost soft. A couple spiky places left still, but the harsh guard hairs have been trimmed down, apparently. So, let's see, what else? The article that I did for amwriting.org went live this morning. It's featured in today's top slot on amwriting.org. It's called Best Case Scenario. And John Moreau released my tribute to his early days as the first podcast mime from his brief stint at the Montmartre School of Mimes to taking his vision of the art to the podosphere, along with some clips from his earliest shows, his best shows. So, if you get a chance, you should find that over there at servingworlds.com. Apparently, I'm featured with David Brin, which is really good company to be in. And David Brin is one of the authors that I'm familiar with and whom I enjoy greatly for the most part. Postman is one of his that I enjoyed, post-apocalyptic vision. And The Uplift War, I think, was another one that I liked a lot. There's several of his books that I read all in a bunch, maybe 15 years ago. I keep looking for some new stuff from him, but I haven't seen a lot. And what I have seen is mostly short fiction. But a couple things that he's put out that haven't really grabbed me. But it could be that I just haven't been in the right frame of mind for them as well. I mentioned Krista D. Balls. Road to Hell, military science fiction yesterday, I think. I've still been pondering that one. I think it's an interesting story that fails probably because of the way I'm reading it. It doesn't fail. I said that wrong. It doesn't... And I don't want to spoil it for people who might want to go out and pick up a copy and read it. It's, I think it's like a $2.99 novel. But... there's something about the book that does not ring true to me, that doesn't smack as, it doesn't strike me as being consistent with the universe or the character that she's created, specifically the character of the captain for whom the story is told, the lead character. Perspective. It's still engaging. I enjoyed it a great deal. And I kept thinking that there was a piece missing. At some point, I'm going to get a chance to talk to Krista about it and see what she has to say. I had that opportunity to talk to Renee Chambliss about... what was it? I want to say Dreamer's Thread. That might be it. No, it's not it. Maybe. Anyway, I thought Dreamer's Thread was Starla Hutchton. Renee Chambliss's book. Anyway, the one about the escape, the girl who goes to prison and apparently dreams she goes to another world to escape. There were some, what I thought to be inconsistencies in the story, and Renee assured me when I talked to her about them that they weren't in fact inconsistent, that's just that the universe wasn't sufficiently fleshed out for them to make sense. That she really intended them to be anomalous. And my problem with it which really made me start thinking about my own writing a little more closely. But my problem with it was, while it may be a symptom of the universe that's not perfectly understood, the reality is that on perception, it looked like a mistake, and it pulled me out of the story. So that's something that I think about when I'm writing these days in particular, is that it has to be not just consistent with the universe, but it has to be consistent with the reader's perception of the universe, or you have to hang a sign on it that says, "That's odd. Why did that happen?" From the point of view of the reader, so that the reader knows, no, that wasn't a mistake. It wasn't a continuity error. It wasn't something that I did by accident. It was, in fact, part of the story. This is particularly important to me at the moment while I'm thinking about Tanith Fairport and her growth and her power, her manifestation of madness. And that in Ravenwood, she doesn't really feel like she's going mad. And yet, in the back of her mind, it's there. But it's not really in the book. I really need to work some more on that to help bring that out, that journey into madness that she goes through in book two. And whether or not she comes out on the other side in book two, or even for that matter, in book three. Because some journeys are one way. Life, for example, is a one-way journey. You don't get to go back. You can try to revisit, but you don't get to go back. You can go to the same theme park next year, but it won't be the same because you'll be different. So, hero's journey and its cycle be damned. Some journeys are one way. Actually, hero's journey is a one-way trip as well, because the hero comes out different than he went in. Perhaps all journeys are one way when you think about that. Other than the trivial going to work in the morning and coming home. Deep thoughts today, very deep philosophical thoughts. They all have to do with Fernando Garcia. This character has called to me. There's something about him, about having had one vision of himself at the beginning of that story, and having a different vision of himself at the end, and how that's portrayed over the course of the story and his interaction with Dr. Mercury. It's a lovely day. I'm almost back. It was good to take the walk now. I won't get a chance later. I'll be too busy being taxi and cook and everything else. But at least I got the walk in. I got the talk in. And now I'm at the back gate. Tomorrow is another day. I'll talk to you then.